Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 98. It's Monday, January 25th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. My first show out of Trump hell. Woohoo! It is great to see and hear press briefings and COVID-19 briefings actually occurring and actually helpful. Who'd have thunk? We had the first COVID-19 briefing since November. And of course, during the Trump administration, they went an entire year without a single press briefing. Aye, aye, aye. Okay, well, on with COVID-19 reporting as it continues to dominate the public health world. First up, from the Associated Press, U.S. COVID-19 numbers drop, but race against new strain heats up. Coronavirus deaths and cases per day in the U.S. dropped markedly over the past couple of weeks, but are still running at alarmingly high levels, and the effort to snuff out COVID-19 is becoming an ever more urgent race between the vaccine and the mutating virus. The government's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, said the improvement in numbers around the country appears to be a result of, quote, natural peaking and then plateauing after a holiday surge, rather than an effect of the rollout vaccines that began in mid-December. Deaths are running at an average of just under 3,100 a day, down from more than 3,350 a day less than 2 weeks ago. New cases are averaging around 170,000 a day after peaking at almost 250,000 a day on January 11th. The number of COVID-19 patients in the hospital in the U.S. has fallen to about 110,000 from a high of 132,000 on January 7th. Fauci also warned that the U.S. shouldn't let its guard down as variants that are more contagious take hold. We don't want to get complacent and think, oh, things are going in the right direction, we can pull back a bit, Fauci said. He said scientists are already preparing to upgrade COVID-19 vaccines to address the mutated versions that erupted in Britain and South Africa. Fauci said there is a very slight, modest diminution of the effectiveness of COVID-19 vaccines against those variants. But there's enough cushion with the vaccines that we have that we still consider them to be effective against both. British authorities have said there's evidence that the variant circulating there may be more deadly than the original. Fauci called the South African variant even more ominous, noting that test tube studies suggest monoclonal antibodies do not work as well as a treatment against it. Moderna, the maker of one of the two vaccines being used in the U.S., announced on last Monday that it is beginning to test a possible booster dose against the South African version. Moderna CEO Stephanie Bancel said the move was out of an abundance of caution after preliminary lab tests suggested its shot produced a weaker immune response to that variant. And in COVID mutation news close to home from Michigan Live, Ann Arbor. The more contagious variant of COVID-19, known as B117, was recently identified in a cluster of University of Michigan students. The school learned of the additional cases over the weekend and fear there could be more discovered in the next several days, university officials said in a campus-wide email Sunday, January 24th. The variant strain was identified as a result of regular university testing, followed by additional testing in U of M labs, the school said. As of this morning, all 8 people with cases of the variant in Washtenaw County have been associated with the University of Michigan. State and local public health officials are working closely with the university to carefully consider proactive and additional mitigation measures to address the emergence of this more contagious B.1.1.7 strain on campus, the university said. The announcement of the additional variant cases comes 2 days after Michigan athletics shut down for 2 weeks as a response to a recent COVID-19 outbreak. The university is working to implement state recommendations regarding athletics, and we applaud the student athletes, staff, and leadership of the department for their rigorous testing and public health protocols. Their testing regimen is helping us address and contain the variant at U of M, and the information we're learning may be able to help our entire community. The first case of the COVID-19 variant was identified in a Washtenaw County woman on January 16th after she returned from the UK, where the virus variant was originally identified. And this from The Hill. Fauci says we can assume now that British virus strain can cause more damage. Anthony Fauci, the nation's top infectious disease expert, said recent data reported by the British government suggests a new, more virulent strain of the coronavirus is also more deadly, but said the U.S. officials need to examine the numbers themselves. When the British investigators looked more closely at the death rate of a certain age group, and they found that it was 1 per 1,000, and then it went up to 1.3 per 1,000 in a certain group, Fauci added, that's a significant increase. So the most recent data is in accord with what the Brits are saying. We want to look at the data ourselves, but we have every reason to believe them. They are a very competent group. Fauci went on to say Americans need to assume now that what has been circulating dominantly in the UK does have a certain increase in what we call virulence, namely the power of the virus to cause more damage, including death. Okay, well, I wanted to do this story because, you know, we talk about the increased infectiousness, which they estimate around 50% greater with this particular strain. And now they're talking about virulence or its ability to cause death or serious disease, as much as 30% here, it looks like, is possible. Although it's still early, so we'll have to see. But one of the things that people were talking about is with this virulence or the ability to cause serious disease or death, in the UK, since they've had a high amount of virus spread, they've actually had a strain in their hospital system, and some of the additional deaths may be due to actually the hospitals being overwhelmed. And it raises the interesting point of what exactly is virulence. Just like we look at the R value, which is the ability for the virus to multiply among people in populations, that is not a singular characteristic of the physical properties of a virus. It's not simply a biological construct. It's also a social construct. It obviously depends on social distancing, mask wearing, the health of a population, all these types of things. Even the seasonality, between summer and winter is something that's not, it's an external environmental thing rather than simply a specific characteristic of the virus itself. So, and I just make this point again, what I've done in earlier shows is that when you have increased infectiousness, you're going to have more deaths. So whether it comes from strained hospital systems or something specific to the virus, or something in the environment, all of these things are particularly deadly, and we have to pay attention to them all. And like Dr. Fauci says, we just need to up our game and continue to be serious about trying to tamp this down before these new, more infectious variants gain dominance. Because the more virus spread we have, the more chance for variants, mutations. And I want to take a small excerpt of this article from Stat News to get it more about that. So what we know and don't know about the coronavirus variants. This section is, what's happening in Brazil? A recent study estimated that 3/4 of residents of the city of Manaus, Brazil, have been infected by the SARS-2 virus by October. The hope is that this level of protection might act as a buffer against more transmission. But last month, cases started rising in the city and its state of Amazonas, straining local health systems once again. When researchers dug into the viral sequences, they found many cases involved a new variant called P1. P1 has also been identified in people who traveled from Brazil to Japan. They warned the mutation it contained is potentially associated with an increase in transmissibility or propensity for reinfection of individuals. scientists suspect there are several potential factors at work in Manaus, which could be playing out together. They are investigating. Maybe P1 is indeed able to evade some existing immune protection, leaving people more susceptible to reinfection. Scientists confirmed a case of reinfection caused by P1 in Amazonas. Or perhaps P1 is so transmissible that it can spread just fine even in communities with 75% protection. Or what if some people in Amazonas who were infected months ago are just generally becoming susceptible again to any form of reinfection, regardless of variants? Though immune responses vary, it's thought that some people who fend off the virus will have lasting protection for some time, but that it will wane eventually. Already, some reinfections have been reported around the world without the involvement of a more transmissible variant. It's thought that reinfections with SARS-2 will generally be milder for most people than their initial case because they still have some immune memory to the virus, even if their system couldn't block infection entirely. Scientists will be looking out to see if that holds with the different variants. And continuing news on one more variant from CNN. Emerging evidence suggests new coronavirus variant could be problematic for vaccines. As researchers around the world race to see if new coronavirus variants will pose a problem for vaccines, a second study in 2 days says a variant from South Africa could possibly do just that. I think the evidence is building that these mutations, and I think other mutations, will emerge across the globe and are emerging already, that are escaping antibodies from previous infection, Alex Sigal, virologist at the Africa Health Research Institute and the Max Planck Institute for Infection Biology, told CNN, "It's concerning. It's unclear whether this means someone would be vulnerable to the new variant if they've already had COVID-19 or what this might mean for people who've been vaccinated." Well, folks, this COVID-19 pandemic and this virus is very tricky. More news to come. And some folks around the world are stepping up their game. This from the Washington Post. Europe's growing mask ask. Ditch the cloth ones for medical-grade coverings. Faced with new, more contagious strains of the coronavirus and a winter surge in cases, European nations have begun to tighten mask regulations in hope that they can slow the spread of the virus. Germany last Tuesday made it mandatory for people riding on public transportation or in supermarkets to wear medical-style masks, either N95s, the Chinese or European equivalent KN95 or FFP2s, or a surgical mask. It allows a stricter regulation from the German state of Bavaria this week that required N95 equivalents in stores and on public transport. Austria will introduce the same measures today. Meanwhile, in France, the country's health advisory council last Monday discouraged the wearing of inefficient cloth and homemade masks, also arguing that they may not offer sufficient protection against the more highly transmissible coronavirus variants. Since we don't have any new weapons against them, the only thing we can do is improve the ones we already have, Daniel Camus, a member of the council, told France's public broadcaster.
Hi, I'm Corey the Coronavirus, and I need your help. Once I'm in your body, I can multiply a gazillion times, but I need your help with my travel plans. I am already a worldwide traveler, but I would love to meet up with you at your workplace, out in public, with your friends, anywhere. I'll gladly meet you at your home if you let me. Hey, look, you don't even have to touch me. I understand, because I do give a flying leap. Look, I know I'm nothing special. Most people get over me, but the odds are that someone you know may just be dying to meet me. And those conspiracy-loving friends of yours? Come on, you know you've got some. I'd love to meet them, even if they don't believe my travel plans. In reality, in their presence, I am inspired over and over and over again. Breathe it in, folks. What you believe doesn't really matter to me. I'm just that kind of guy. Well, I've got to get going. I'm really making the rounds these days. Hey, keep in touch, and I really do mean it. But if I don't run into you soon, remember, I'll be back.
This message has been brought to you by Pandemic Travel Bureau. We only go where you have already been, which is why the price you pay to travel with us is never really worth it. Please note, the purchase of any travel plan does not include 6-foot pole.
Okay, and if you were waiting for an anthropologist's take on the COVID-19 epidemic, here's one from Stat News. Staying safe in the time of coronavirus. Pay attention to the guy you know. For the last 9 months, my team of anthropologists and I have been asking people across the United States to tell us their experiences of living during a global pandemic. We have seen a dangerous theme emerge: the belief that danger of the virus comes from strangers, and that friendship and family ties can cancel contagion. Though logical, these interpretations of biology are wrong, sometimes dead wrong. What we are seeing in our data from this project has a twist on the idea of other. People are telling themselves stories about the safety of people they know. This means that many people report what they're doing everything possible to stay safe, and to the next breath, tell us about a party they attended for the holidays with friends and family. It's okay, they say. We knew everybody there. It is within the intimacy of friendship and love that people assume safety and tamp down the stories of risk. The take-home messages from our interviews is that all of us should take a good look at the chances we take and who we consider to be safe, and remain careful about exposure and risk through this dark winter until the pandemic lets up, and before we make choices that could end up in despair. And in a related story from Science Daily, people more likely to follow COVID rules when friends and family do, research finds. New research has shown that people are more likely to follow COVID-19 restrictions based on what their friends do rather than their own principles. The researchers found that people didn't simply follow the rules if they felt vulnerable or were personally convinced. Most diligent followers of the guidelines were those whose friends and family also followed the rules. Close circles compliance had an even stronger effect than people's own approval of the rules. This discovery applied to all age groups, genders, countries, and was independent of the severity of the pandemic and the strength of restrictions. The study also revealed that people who were particularly bonded to their country were more likely to stick to lockdown rules. The country was like family in this way, someone for whom one is willing to stick their neck out. Public policies are on the wrong track. We see scientists and politicians trying to boost the public's approval of the measures so that vaccination campaigns and lockdowns get the support of the citizens, but approval does not mean compliance. You may make up your own mind about the measures or listen to experts, but eventually what you do largely depends on what your close friends do, said Ophelia DeRoy, who is a professor of philosophy of mind and neuroscience at Ludwig Maximilian University of Munich. Yes, my friends, just another powerful reminder that we are not independent, isolated, rational beings, but we are social creatures and pay very close attention to our social cues of those closest around us. Okay, well, the next story, I just want to take a brief excerpt because it had a good framing of relative risk, because it's hard to understand risk sometimes. This is from Science Daily. COVID-19 is dangerous for middle-aged adults, not just the elderly. And here it is. For a person who is middle-aged, the risk of dying from COVID-19 is about 100 times greater than dying from an automobile accident. Okay, stop and meditate on that one for a moment. And then let's get to the local update. For Lucas County, the average amount of daily cases over the last 7 days went down again to 198 cases per day of new infections identified. This is the lowest level we've seen in about 11 weeks, so good news. In another change of my reporting here today from the sources of data I'm doing, I am sick and tired of the local testing data being so unreliable and untimely. So I am dumping local testing data and moving directly to the CDC, which does offer county-level info and a variety of things, including testing. And in doing this, I've learned a couple things. The CDC data actually indicates a higher level of testing in Lucas County than our local data shows, which recently shows about 1,300 tests a day in Lucas County. That was better than what we've mostly seen from the local reports. Still, this higher level that CDC reports is lower than the per capita testing rate that we see in Ohio as a whole. But I guess the good news is that since CDC seems to know about more tests overall than the local health department, this leads to lower positivity rates. And their most recent reporting for positivity rate for Lucas County was 13.4%. Now, of course, this is a crappy rate. It's way above the 5% or less that we want to be to have an indication of adequate testing. but it's way better than the two or three times that rate that has been what has been calculated from the actual local data. So one of the major functions of public health is to do assessment. Data collection matters. Crappy data gives you crappy view of what's actually going on. So this is good news, and I think we got a better data source, and it's good news because it looks like the positivity rates are lower than what I have been reporting on, because the local data, just for whatever reason, isn't accurate. And as a data geek, I will pursue with the local epidemiologist why that might be the case. But since the CDC has a nice dashboard, I'm going to use that. Okay, well, more good news. In Ohio, the positivity testing rate has moved down to 8.9%, and that's dropped rather fast. From the previous week, it was 10.9%, and the week before that, it was 13.8%. So that's good. On the bad news front, I guess, is that Ohio testing volumes have continued to edge down again last week. Local testing, as far as getting a positive test result returned to the health department, held steady at about 3.6 days. That means from the point somebody's tested, and if they end up being positive, it takes 3.6 days for the health department to get that test result. That ideally should be 24 to 48 hours. So that metric we're not meeting. But there is some good news in Ohio on testing, and here it is from cleveland.com. Ohio to purchase 2 million rapid coronavirus tests to send to local health departments. The state of Ohio entered a deal with two healthcare companies to purchase at least 2 million rapid antigen coronavirus tests to dole out to local health departments for broader use, Governor Mike DeWine said. DeWine described the $50 million deal with Abbott Pharmaceuticals and EMED as a significant expansion of testing for the public that will make the instant test more widely available, providing a tool for local health departments to respond to potential outbreaks in communities. Along with the test from Abbott, EMED will also provide telehealth services for anyone who takes one. We have used CARES Act dollars, and this will make testing more broadly available, DeWine said. We've given local health departments some broad guidelines. We've asked them to make the test widely available in their communities. The rapid tests won't be widely available to the public the way regular tests are, known as PCR tests. Instead, DeWine said the state is giving guidelines to the local health departments, which can decide how to best use them. We have suggested, for example, they use them for first responders to be able to take advantage of this type of testing, DeWine said. We've heard some communities will use them in their schools, which I will add will be a welcome change, since there's been no regular testing in schools like ever in our Lucas County schools, at least not in public schools. I think some of the private schools might have done some of it. DeWine said they entered into the agreement after receiving requests from local health departments for months to expand access to the rapid tests. The rapid tests from Abbott, which can be taken at home, provide results in as little as 15 minutes. Anyone who takes a test will be provided with a remote proctor via EMED, eliminating the need to go to traditional testing facility. PCR tests, the traditional tests, require a nasal swab and can take days or longer to get a result, depending how quickly the lab is able to turn around their results. Antigen tests are often less accurate than PCR tests. However, the Ohio Department of Health Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Bruce Vanderhoff, said the rapid tests were much more likely to yield a false negative than a false positive, meaning that it might miss some true positives, but is not that likely to give a positive test when somebody isn't really positive. Okay. Having some information on possible outbreaks was better than having no information, and the quality of the tests has also increased significantly. A positive antigen test allows for those potentially exposed to know they need to isolate quicker, possibly limiting coronavirus spread. I think those two facts together really make it prudent to get as many tests out in the public, out into people's hands as we possibly can, Dr. Vanderhoff said. Okay, well, Lucas County nursing homes still suffer from a high rate of active cases with 162. 102 residents and 60 staff have active cases, as most recently reported, although this is down from the around 190 to over 200 that have been reported in the last month or so. And the positivity rate has dropped to 14%, which, as you'll note, is higher than for the community overall, showing that it's very difficult to protect staff and residents in long-term care facilities, one of the dangers of congregate living. Now, last week, they hadn't updated the positivity rate, so I'll give that to you now. The week prior to that, it was 16.3%, and compared to the week even before that, was 18%. So we've dropped 4 percentage points down to 14% in the last couple weeks. That's good news, even though it's unfortunately high. Okay, well, while cases have gone down, deaths are at an all-time high. Lucas County death rate over the last 14 days is higher than the state and national death rates, with a total of 70 deaths in the last 14 days, which is up from 56 in the most recent week before that. This is the highest death rate we've had since the first wave locally. Okay, in more news as far as hospitalizations, I am also moving away from the Department of Health and Human Services data dump that they do. It gives a lot of detailed information by facility because it hasn't been accurate, it hasn't been timely. So I'm moving directly to the aforementioned CDC dashboard. New hospitalizations in Lucas County have been similar over the recent weeks, unfortunately rather high, which is probably indicative of why our death rate has been high. Fortunately for the state of Ohio as a whole, the COVID-19 hospitalizations are trending down, and we're just above 3,000 as a daily census count for COVID patients in Ohio hospitals. And this is the lowest we've seen in months, and almost a one-quarter drop in 2 weeks. Good news. Let's try to keep it up. The University of Toledo is still doing surveillance testing. They had 23 identified positives. And their surveillance testing, of meaning people that they just kind of randomly test, only had a 0.6% positivity, down from 1.7, which is more typically what it has been in recent weeks that they've been in session, or recent months that they've been in session. So UT seems to be doing all right. Classes are getting back, so we'll see how that goes. Similarly, with the Lucas County schools, although they don't have any regular testing, in the most recent week, they reported 44 staff and 84 students. Because there's not a really good surveillance program, it's not really able to say if that varies wildly from what the community transmission rates are. But there's the numbers for you. Okay, and what everybody's concerned about now is vaccine started. And I'm going to add this week, the United States. I've been comparing Ohio and Lucas County, but let's compare it to the U.S. As of today, 21.8 million doses have been injected into the arms of residents of the United States, and that is 6.6% of the population. In Ohio, we've had 627,000 doses administered, which is 5.4% of the population. And in Lucas County, we've had over 26,000 doses administered, which is 6.2% of the population. So you see that, as I reported earlier, Lucas County is doing a little bit better than the state as a whole, but both the state and Lucas County are doing slightly worse than the United States as a whole. Okay, well, the overall good news on the vaccination front is that this may be the first week that we've actually created more immunity through vaccinations than have occurred through people getting infected. This is the way we want people to develop immunity, not by potentially getting very sick and dying. Okay, well, Toledo Lucas County Health Department, received about 5,800 doses last week, and it looks like this is the amount that we're going to be getting for the foreseeable future here. You can go to lucashealth.org to pre-register and get full information on local vaccination sites. If you need language assistance or have a poor internet access, you can call 211 and you can get some assistance. If you are over 65 and you need assistance, somebody to walk you through the registration process or setting up an appointment, you can call the Area Office of Aging at 419-382-0624. Again, that is 419-382-0624, the Area Office of Aging. Okay, people, well, this is WAKT, We Act Radio, 106.1 FM, Toledo, and you are listening to the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. So let's get on with it. And let's continue with some stories about the vaccination issues. This from The Hill. Disjointed vaccine distribution poses early tests for Biden. States, counties, and cities say they are running out of coronavirus vaccines, leading to canceled or postponed appointments for thousands of people, even as the country tries to ramp up the pace of vaccinations. Health officials are desperate for clarity from the federal government on vaccine shipments, saying they need accurate numbers for planning weeks in advance. Instead, the figures have been coming in only a week at a time and have not been consistent. The Biden administration has pledged to work with states to improve communication, but is now scrambling to figure out just how much vaccine is available. Allocation and supply are critical areas that we did not, unfortunately, have much visibility into, Jeff Zients, President Biden's COVID-19 coordinator, told reporters. We will work to provide projections on supply. We hear over and over from governors and local leaders that they just don't know what supply is coming and can't plan. We will absolutely, across the next few days, as we get our arms around what's going on, make sure that we are communicating with states and localities so they can prepare effectively, Zients added. Health experts and federal officials have said for months that initial COVID-19 vaccines were going to be in short supply. In the first 2 weeks after the vaccines gained emergency authorization, states were having a hard time administrating them quickly enough. Now demand is higher, states have streamlined their administration systems, and the supply can't keep up. Meanwhile, demand has far outstripped supply in some areas. This week, New York City had to reschedule 23,000 appointments after exhausting the city's supply for first doses. Mayor Bill de Blasio sent a letter to the Biden administration asking for flexibility to use its supply of second doses to bridge the gap of a time of increased production and maximize the number of first doses administered. The unpredictable and erratic flow of vaccine into San Francisco made it impossible for the city's healthcare providers or Department of Public Health to plan appropriately, said the city's COVID command center in a statement to The Hill. The Biden administration has been praised for being more open about the challenges in combating the coronavirus, but officials have not spelled out how they can increase vaccine supply. And the bad news, as told by the New York Times, Biden inherits a vaccine supply unlikely to grow before April. As the Biden administration takes power with a pledge to tame the most dire public health crisis in a century, one pillar of its strategy is to significantly increase the supply of COVID-19 vaccines. But federal health officials and corporate executives agree that it will be impossible to increase the immediate supply of vaccines before April because of lack of manufacturing capacity. The administration should first focus, experts say, on fixing the hodgepodge of state and local vaccination centers that has proved incapable of managing even the current flow of vaccines. The current vaccination effort, which has little central direction, has sown confusion and frustration. Some localities are complaining they are running out of doses, while others have unused vials sitting on shelves. President Biden is asking Congress for $20 billion to vastly expand vaccination centers, to include stadiums, pharmacies, doctor offices, and mobile clinics. He also wants to hire 100,000 healthcare workers and to use federal disaster relief funds to reimburse states and local governments for vaccination costs. Dr. Mark McClellan, the director of Duke University's Health Policy Center, said those moves should help clear the bottlenecks and push the number beyond 1 million doses a day and probably significantly beyond. The nation's vaccine supply in the first 3 months of the year is expected to substantially exceed what is needed to meet the administration's goal. According to a senior administration official, Pfizer, BioNTech, and Moderna have been ramping up and are now on track to deliver up to 18 million doses a week. Together, they have pledged to deliver 200 million doses by the end of March. A third vaccine maker, Johnson & Johnson, might also come through with more doses. If all of that supply were used, the nation could average well over 2 million shots a day. From April on, the supply outlook brightens. Pfizer and Moderna have each committed to supply another 100 million doses by the end of July, and the companies might be able to provide even more. A week ago, Pfizer and BioNTech, its German partner, increased their global production target for the year to 2 billion doses from 1.3 billion doses. Okay, as an editorial note, if you do the math, the 200 million doses we're getting through up until April is not much different than the 200 million doses that we're talking about getting in the 4 months after that through July. So it's probably going to have to be other manufacturers other than the two that we have now. Okay, well, let's see. What does that look like? Johnson & Johnson is expected to announce results from its vaccine trial within days. If that vaccine proves effective, it may drastically speed up the pace of vaccinations because, unlike Moderna's and Pfizer BioNTech's vaccines, it requires only one dose. The company could apply for emergency use authorization from the FDA as soon as the end of the month. While its manufacturing has lagged, Johnson & Johnson is trying to catch up to the goals detailed in a federal contract it signed last year. The firm is now expected to deliver anywhere from several million to 12 million doses by the end of February, and 10 to 20 million more doses by the end of March or the first week of April. Okay, very modest when you do the math, according to several people familiar with the firm's manufacturing output. The first batch will be produced at its Dutch factory and later batches at its factory in Baltimore operated by its manufacturing partner, Emergent BioSolutions. Johnson & Johnson is also in preliminary talks with Merck, a major American pharmaceutical company, about using its production lines, one of several ideas the federal health officials discussed with the Biden transition team. Federal officials are interested in boosting the nation's vaccine-making power long-term, and Merck's facilities may be among the few with remaining manufacturing capability. But Dr. McClellan, who sits on Johnson & Johnson's board of directors, said it would take months to adapt Merck's factory to produce Johnson & Johnson's vaccine. A senior administration official predicted it could take until the end of the year. Other vaccine makers may also come through by mid-year. Novavax has worked to iron out what were recently dire manufacturing problems that delayed its clinical trials. Moncef Slaoui, the chief scientific advisor for the Trump administration's vaccine development program, said in a recent interview that Novavax could apply for emergency use authorization in late April. The government has already ordered 110 million doses of the Novavax vaccine to be delivered by the end of June, and Novavax has said it believes it can meet that target. Okay, well, we're going to need quite a portfolio of vaccines to really ramp up. Hopefully that goes well. We'll keep an eye on that. Okay, well, here's an opinion piece from Stat News that could potentially speed up the effectiveness of a vaccine campaigns. Antibody-assisted vaccination will speed the path to protection. Given the low risk of reinfection and the limited supply of vaccine doses, it would be a mistake not to make previous infection a more central consideration in our vaccine prioritization. With an estimated 75 million Americans having already been infected, and I would note that another estimate is like 105 million, so it's a lot, but only 24 million knowing it, using wide-scale COVID-19 antibody testing can help better target vaccine allocation to those at highest risk. Doing so can save lives and return us to normalcy sooner. This strategy builds upon the two biggest discoveries made in efforts against the virus. The first is that after infection, including mild and asymptomatic infections, there appears to be lasting and strong immunity out to at least 6+ months. The fact that there have been nearly 100 million cases of COVID-19 confirmed worldwide and only a handful of documented reinfections provides convincing evidence of lasting immunity. And even among the rare reinfections, their course will likely be milder thanks to the immune system's memory. This combination of lasting immunity and effective vaccines has been the cornerstone of almost all past successes against viruses, HIV to date being the key exception. It's how the scourge of smallpox, polio, measles, mumps, and other infectious diseases have been beaten, and it's how we're going to beat COVID-19. But even in the best case scenario, it will be months before enough vaccine doses have been made to treat everyone who wants one, with epidemiologists estimating that 70 to 85% of the population must be immune for the herd protection needed to quell the pandemic. An antibody-assisted approach would let us reach that threshold faster. And I particularly like this opinion piece because you haven't really heard much about that. We focus on the vaccination, but the fact is, if about 30% of Americans have in fact been infected and may very well, very likely, have some immunity, perhaps sterilizing or protective immunity, it would make sense with a vaccine shortage to go ahead and vaccinate people who have no immunity and prioritize them. So you haven't seen a lot of that in the prioritization schemes. And of course, it would require the testing to see if people have the antibody, which is not that complicated. But of course, the vaccination distribution has been so roughshod that adding this layer may in fact be too much of a problem. But certainly on paper, it would be a really good idea. And it just shows the big difference between knowing scientific facts and what's a good strategy and what actually gets implemented on the ground can be two very different things. But something I'm glad to hear that perhaps some people are considering. Okay, well, the difference between what's on paper and what happens in the real world is often the psychology and sociology of a disease. So I want to do this article from Science Daily. Experts tap into behavioral research to promote COVID-19 vaccination in the United States. As the first doses of COVID-19 vaccines are being rolled out, it is still unclear whether enough Americans are willing to be vaccinated to allow the nation to return to normalcy. Many believe a key part of the equation lies in how effective vaccine communication teams are at convincing the public to get vaccinated. And the key to effective communication tactics in promoting the vaccines may lie in demonstrated behavioral economics and consumer behavior theory, experts say. The country has made an incredible investment in fast-tracking SARS-CoV-2 vaccines from conception to market, which would make it even more tragic if we fail to curtail the virus simply because Americans are hesitant to be vaccinated, said Stacy Wood, an expert on how consumers respond to change and innovation, and the first author of a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine titled Beyond Politics, Promoting COVID-19 Vaccination in the U.S. Wood is a professor of marketing, executive director of the Consumer Innovation Collaborative at the North Carolina State Poole College of Management. Since Anthony Fauci has said that at least 80% of the population will need to be vaccinated to get the country back to normalcy, would note that this means it will be necessary to get 100% follow-through from those who are more likely to get the vaccine and 100% conversion of those who are unlikely now but willing to keep an open mind. That is a daunting prospect. To address this challenge, Wood and her colleague Kevin Shulman of Stanford drew on their expertise in behavioral economics and consumer research to develop 12 strategies that would collectively create an effective promotion effort. Proposed strategies include using analogy. Many attitudes toward the current pandemic are responses to complex medical information. Analogies are shortcuts to conceptual understanding, saying the war against COVID is a term rich in meaning coming together, making sacrifices, doing tough things, and emerging on the other side with new improvements and inventions in hand. Or one can explain that mRNA vaccines are not weak doses of the virus, but instead are instruction manuals that teach the immune system how to defend itself. Increase observability. Studies have shown consumers' ability to observe others' choices can increase an innovation's rate of adoption. Distributing tokens, such as Live Strong-style bracelets or stickers, or digital badges, such as social media profile frames, may prove to be effective in increasing consumer buy-in. They can even be specific to different populations. Stickers that say, COVID-19 frontline hero, I'm vaccinated, or America honor her veterans, I'm vaccinated. America honors her veterans, I'm vaccinated. Leverage natural scarcity. In consumer markets, scarcity often signals exclusivity and prompts greater interest or desirability. Communicators should frame early access to vaccines as a mark of honor or respect for people who want to protect, such as the elderly, teachers, or essential workers. Leveraging scarcity, especially as a vaccine is slowly rolled out, may help to counteract many individuals' natural hesitancy to go first. Promote compromise options. Consider coffee shops that offer 3 serving sizes and typically sell more of the middle option. This decision rule of thumb is based on choice preferences for compromise or middle options. When it comes to the vaccine, communicators should not make vaccination seem like an either-or decision, but rather should frame it as 3 options where vaccination is in the middle. For instance, options could include allowing people to get the shot now, signing up for a later date, or not getting at all. Or all 3 options could include the vaccine, such as getting a shot now and donate plasma, simply get the shot now, or get the shot later. The key is to avoid depicting vaccination as the most extreme action in a range of choices. And another similar article on that theme, this from Scientific American. The best evidence for how to overcome COVID vaccine fears. Operation Warp Speed has certainly lived up to its name. The arrival of the first coronavirus vaccines less than a year after the pandemic began blew away the previous development record of 4 years, which was held by the mumps vaccine. Now, social scientists and public health communications pros must clear another hurdle, ensuring that enough people actually roll up their sleeve and give the shots a shot, 2 doses per person for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines, that won emergency use authorization from the U.S. FDA in mid-December. Somewhere between 60 and 90% of adults and children must be vaccinated or have antibodies resulting from infection in order to arrive at the safe harbor known as herd immunity, where the whole community is protected. After months of rising death tolls, a collapsing economy, activity restrictions, and fears of falling ill, many Americans are eager to be immunized. In a nationally representative survey of almost 1,700 U.S. adults conducted in early December by the Kaiser Family Foundation, 71% said they would definitely or probably get a vaccine for COVID-19, up from 63% in September. A November Pew Research Center survey showed a similar rise. But there are large segments of the U.S. population that remain reluctant or opposing to receiving the vaccines. In the Kaiser Family Foundation poll, 42% of Republicans said they definitely or probably would not. The same was true for 35% of black adults who, as a group, have borne a disproportionate share of sickness and death from COVID-19. Also deeply hesitant were 35% of rural residents, 36% of adults aged 30 to 49, and especially worrisome given their public-facing roles, 33% of essential workers and 29% of those who work in a healthcare delivery setting. For the reluctant and distrustful, it will take targeted actions and communication strategies that speak to the specific concerns of each group to move them toward accepting the new vaccines. The most effective messenger in the black community won't be the same as one among Republicans, obviously, says political scientist Brendan Nyhan of Dartmouth College, who studies misperceptions about healthcare and politics. We need to meet each community where they are and understand the reasons for the mistrust. Even among the willing, it will take a concerted effort by public health officials to ensure that good intentions translate into action. Whether it's getting out to vote or showing up for a vaccination, one-third to two-thirds of people who say they will do something wind up flaking out, says Katie Milkman, co-director of the Behavior Change for Good Initiative at the University of Pennsylvania, where she researches ways to close the intention-action gap. Health communication specialists like to say that public health moves at the speed of trust. Fortunately, research by Nyhan and Milken and many others point to ways that build trust and prompt more people to step up and get vaccinated. Surprisingly, these strategies include not directly contradicting people's mistaken ideas about vaccine dangers and instead approaching them with empathy. That approach means acknowledging historical reasons for medical distrust among people of color and working with leaders within their communities. For Republican skeptics, it may involve messages that are less about the risk of COVID and more about giving the economy a shot in the arm. Okay, first up, the willing majority. Most Americans want to be vaccinated against SARS-CoV-2, the virus responsible for the deaths of about one in every 1,000 Americans. Seniors are especially eager, according to the Kaiser Family Foundation survey. 85% of adults aged 65 and older said they probably or definitely will get a vaccine. Their enthusiasm makes sense given their heightened vulnerability to a life-threatening case of COVID-19. Elderly people in nursing homes and assisted living facilities are among the first to receive the vaccines, which, under federal plans, are being delivered to such residences by the country's two largest pharmacy chains, CVS Health and Walgreens, along with some pharmacies in the Managed Healthcare Associates Network. Seniors living independently and younger people will have to wait their turn for wider distribution and then make a personal effort to get their shot. That is where things often break down, Milkman says. When people fail to get their annual flu shot, for example, she says, there's an assumption of some deep-seated desire not to do it, some deep fear of undesirable side effects. But actually, a really common reason is that they forgot. It's a little bit of a hassle, and they don't get around to it. Research shows that some surprisingly simple interventions can make a difference. The one with the biggest proved impact, Milkman says, is to make the desired case, in this case vaccination, the default. A 2010 study at Rutgers University showed that informing people that a dose of flu vaccine was waiting for them at a specified time and place, although the appointment could be changed, boosted their vaccination rate by 36% compared to a control group that was emailed a web link to schedule their own appointment. In other words, opt-out works better than opt-in. Another effective tactic is sending relentless reminders. Milkman points to a 2019 study involving 1,100 patients with tuberculosis in Kenya. Its goal was to get more people to complete their drug treatment regimen. About half of the participants were assigned to a control group. The others got daily text messages reminding them to take their meds. If they did not respond in the affirmative, they got two more text reminders that day, and if that failed, phone calls. The strategy was basically just nagging the heck out of them, as Milkman puts it. Nearly 96% of patients in the NAG group were treated successfully, compared with about 87% of the control group. And to make that a little more understandable, I'd like to say nearly 96% means about 4%, and the 87% means about 13%. So you improved you reduced the non-compliance rate from about 13% to about 4%. Sounds a lot better that way. So that's one way of communicating statistics. Okay. To determine what kinds of reminders work best, Milkman and her colleagues, Angela Duckworth and Mitesh Patel, have conducted studies with Walmart pharmacies and with two regional healthcare systems to field test a variety of text messages designed to nudge people toward getting the influenza vaccine. The team is still scrutinizing its data, but early analyses of vaccination records from the healthcare systems suggest that simple reminders to request a flu shot sent days or hours before a doctor's appointment appear to be really valuable. Milkman says, "We try to be interactive and funny, and not sure that any of that was necessary," she notes. The study, whose results will be released early this year, was timed to inform efforts around the coronavirus vaccines. Okay, the movable middle. The U.S. Department of Health and Human Services is rolling out its own messaging and communication plan for the vaccines, some of which feature such high credibility figures as Anthony Fauci, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Disease, and the Surgeon General. According to a preliminary document obtained by the New York Times, the campaign will target the movable middle, people who may have some hesitation about getting a shot, but are not dead set against it. Despite all the publicity the anti-vaccination movement has received in recent years, social scientists who study vaccine refusal say hardcore anti-vaxxers are a tiny group and are probably not worth worrying about. For instance, only 2.5% of U.S. kindergartners were exempted from all vaccines, according to 2019 CDC data. "We are more interested in targeting people who might be ambivalent to nudge them in the right direction," said Rupali Limaye, a health communication scientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. Researchers by LeMayer and others reveal some do's and don'ts about nudging the somewhat wary. "One thing that we've learned very clearly is not to correct misperceptions because people feel as though we are being dismissive," she says. In fact, a large 2014 study found by NIAID found that informing parents that there was no credible data linking autism to the vaccine for measles, mumps, and rubella, and providing facts about the very real dangers of the disease had no impact on their intention to vaccinate a child. Instead, such a strategy actually hardened negative views among the most vaccine-averse. Rather than contradicting someone's views, it is better to come at them with empathy. She suggests responding to misinformation by saying something like, "There's a lot of information out there, and some of it's true and some of it's not true. Let me tell you what I know." That kind of reply, says Limier, helps people feel that they are being listened to. Medical personnel can also build rapport by framing the decision in a personal way. "Let me tell you why I vaccinated my own children." Such statements leverage the single most trusted source of health information for most Americans, their own healthcare providers. The fact that healthcare workers are first in line for the coronavirus vaccines gives them a crucial opportunity to set an example and offer first-person validation for worried individuals. The gradual and very public rollout of the new vaccines provides the opportunity to make vaccination for COVID a new norm, something that everyone will be doing. Studies show people make choices such as buying flood insurance or solar panels for their home because their neighbors have done so. And the exact same thing is true for vaccinations, observes Dietram Schufeli, a professor of life sciences communication at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He and Milkman think it might be a good idea to hand out stickers that say, "I got vaccinated," much like the "I voted" stickers used to propel people to the polls, or to do the digital equivalent with a Facebook profile filter. If celebrities and sports stars join the trend, so much the better. Okay, on to reluctant minority groups. More specific and targeted messages and actions will be needed to address vaccine hesitancy among minority, racial, and ethnic groups. The obstacles for these populations tend to fall into two buckets: those related to access and those related to trust, says Samantha Artiga, Vice President and Director of the Kaiser Family Foundation's Racial Equity and Health Policy Program. Access barriers include where and when the vaccine is available. Can individuals who do not own a car or who work late-night shifts easily get immunized? What about workers who have no unpaid sick leave and have legitimate fears about side effects from the shots? Vaccine distribution and communication plans will need to address these issues and avoid mistakes made with the availability of COVID testing. Another reason access can be a problem for people of color is that they are less likely to have health insurance and an existing relationship with a provider. Ensuring that people understand that there is no cost associated with the vaccine is very important, Artiga said. Issues involving trust are rooted in past and present discrimination. Historical abuses by the U.S. government, such as the forced sterilization of thousands of Native American women and the unethical Tuskegee study conducted on black men with syphilis, both of which continued into the 1970s, have left lingering fears and skepticism of government research and health authorities. People of color continue to face racism in the healthcare system, including barriers to treatment and testing for COVID, which has killed nearly three times as many black, Hispanic, and Native Americans as white ones. This inequity was highlighted in the tragic case of Susan Moore, a black doctor in Indiana, who publicly decried bias in her medical treatment for COVID. Moore succumbed to the infection in late December. "You can't say it's time for the vaccination Now, believe in us, leaving aside the entire atmosphere of negligence, haphazardness, and inequity surrounding caring for people with COVID and preventing COVID, says Zachary Berger, a bioethicist and associate professor of medicine at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. Berger is critical, for example, of the way New York City handled communication about the pandemic with Orthodox Jewish communities, some of which have shown resistance to physical distancing measures and have a history of vaccine hesitancy. Shuttering schools in the zip codes where such individuals live and calling them out publicly for congregating in large numbers has made them feel targeted rather than protected. To earn their trust in the new vaccines, public health leaders will need to seek out sources of authority within those communities, Berger says. You have to listen and work with them, he adds. Immigrants, particularly those who are undocumented, may have other concerns about getting vaccinated, such as having their data shared with immigration authorities. In the past few years, such fears led many immigrants to become reluctant to rely on government services. They might not show up for vaccination unless state and local health authorities are really clear about what information is being collected as people obtain the vaccine, what the information will be used for, and what it can't be used for, and where it is going. For Black Americans, health authorities will need to address heightened concerns about vaccine side effects. In the Kaiser Family Foundation survey, 71% of vaccine-hesitant Black respondents reported that their number one issue with COVID immunizations, that this was their number one issue with COVID immunizations, whereas 59% of all people disinclined to get the shot did so. Black respondents were also twice as likely to worry they might get COVID-19 from immunization. Given high levels of medical distrust, we must be forthcoming about what we know and what we don't know about the new vaccine, says Leticia DiSarcisse, health commissioner of Baltimore. Involving a variety of trusted messengers with roots in communities of color was one takeaway from a Baltimore flu vaccine campaign conducted last year. DiSarcisse's team worked with local faith leaders in historically Black colleges and held focus groups to understand what messaging would speak most to them. She says, to reach younger African Americans, she and her colleagues held a webinar with a local pastor who has a strong Black millennial following on social media. Then we chopped up the video and put it on Instagram. Such community contacts and social media influencers will be part of the city's COVID vaccination effort. Okay, skeptical Republicans. An unusual aspect of COVID vaccine hesitancy in the U.S. is its political dimension, which is not a consideration with other adult vaccines, such as those for influenza or shingles. Throughout the pandemic, President Donald Trump, other Republican leaders, and right-wing media have downplayed the risks of the disease, discounted the value of face masks and other protective measures, and questioned official infection and fatality numbers, all of which has muddied attitudes towards the vaccines. More than 4 out of 10 Republicans told pollsters that they do not want to be immunized. And unlike every other group polled, they trusted one figure more than their own doctor for COVID-related information, Trump. Asked to name their most trusted sources, 85% of vaccine-hesitant Republicans named the president, former president. Their own doctor provider ranked a distant second at 67%, and the FDA and Centers for Disease Control and Prevention were trusted by only one-third. Health communication experts note that this situation is unprecedented and, as with other reluctant groups, calls for specific response. It should help, they say, that such prominent Republicans such as the former Vice President Mike Pence and Senate Majority, now Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, got vaccinated on camera. It would be great if all the Fox News anchors got vaccinated on air. Most powerful of all, however, would be Trump doing the same, an example he is not publicly committed to setting. Schofield suggests that more Republicans might be persuaded if health authorities frame vaccine messages in ways that resonate with their core values. Such messages might emphasize that the sooner the American public is vaccinated, the sooner we can fully open restaurants, hotels, gyms, and churches, and return to an economy that allows businesses to thrive. That kind of message will have broad crossover appeal, regardless of political persuasion. All of us want to get back to normal. Okay, moving targets. With so many unknowns about the two current vaccines and those awaiting FDA authorization, including rare side effects and how long protection will last, communication will need to be nimble and responsive. Transparency will be key as new phases roll out, problems arise, and data emerge, according to experts who presented at a recent National Academy of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine webinar on vaccine confidence. The harder part, they noted, will be dealing with misinformation and irresponsible reporting, such as news stories that highlight vaccine mishaps and adverse effects without providing context on how often they occur. That has already been a problem with some reports about an Alaskan healthcare worker who suffered a severe allergic reaction without noticing that tens of thousands have been vaccinated without major incidents. No matter how nimble well-targeted and research-based vaccine communication turns out to be, it will not paper over the underlying reasons for distrust or the structural disparities in public health that the pandemic has revealed. Striving to be a good communicator and empathetic is of ethical importance. It makes healthcare better, but it's not a systemic solution, says medical ethicist Berger. He and other experts hope that if the vaccines usher in a post-pandemic return to normal, it will be a new normal with far fewer inequalities. Okay, well, I'd like to end the show with some good news and then a caveat for that good news. From the Associated Press, another record decline reported in U.S. cancer death rate. Researchers reported another record one-year decline in the U.S. cancer death rate, a drop they attribute to success against lung cancer. The overall cancer death rate has been falling since 1991. From 2007 to 2018, it fell 2.4%, according to the American Cancer Society report, topping the record 2.2% drop reported the year before. Lung cancer accounted for almost half of the overall decline in cancer deaths in the past 5 years, the society reported. Most lung cancer cases are tied to smoking, and decades of declining smoking rates have led to falling rates of lung cancer illnesses and deaths. But experts say the drops in deaths has been accelerated by refinements in surgery, better diagnostic scanning, more precise use of radiation, and the impact of newer drugs. Both men and women who are diagnosed with lung cancer are surviving longer, and that's really fantastic news, says Dr. Deborah Schrag, Chief of Population Sciences at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. Cancer remains the country's second leading cause of death after heart disease. An estimated 1.9 million new U.S. cancer cases will be diagnosed this year. Nearly 609,000 Americans will die from cancer this year, the society estimates. Okay, and the caveat for that? From the journal Pediatrics, use of e-cigarettes and other tobacco products and progression to daily cigarette smoking. And I'm going to read just a conclusion here, but this is what really matters. Trying e-cigarettes and multiple other tobacco products before age 18 is strongly associated with later daily cigarette smoking. The recent large increase in e-cigarette use will likely reverse the decline in cigarette smoking among U.S. young adults. And of course, getting young adults to not pick up smoking is what drives smoking rates, and virtually all people who smoke started when they were young adults. So hopefully we can keep those cancer rates down. I'd also like just to point out this last article is a good example of kind of the debates and the science that's needed to really answer the question whether e-cigarettes are a harm reduction method. Some people thought that, well, by, you know, e-cigarettes are potentially safer than cigarettes, so shouldn't we, you know, promote e-cigarettes over cigarette use? You know, it's an argument that deserved attention, but of course, as it turns out, with experience, what we've learned by studying this is that, in fact, e-cigarettes do lead to even greater cigarette use adoption and other tobacco use adoption later, which, of course, will lead to all the disease and death that tobacco causes. Well, that does it for today's show. If you have any questions or comments, feel free to email me at wakt@toppun.com. You can queue up future shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT, or you can like my Facebook page, Just for the Health of It, WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, and you will get notified when new shows are up and ready for consumption. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Donald Trump Memorial Studio, and I'll be ending with a quote from the great Mahatma Gandhi. When I despair, I remember that all through history, the way of truth and love has always won. There have been tyrants and murderers, and for a time they can seem invincible, but in the end, they always fall. Always. And let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. I need some justice.